earlier this week in the New York Times had a story, sad suspicions about scores in basketball fixing in the sport of college basketball. And the gentleman who was quoted extensively in the stories is Justin Wolfers. Justin is nice enough to join us. He's at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, an assistant professor, of business and public policy. Justin, thank you very much for coming on.
Chad, happy to chat.
What caused you to look into this particular story?
It's just a strange thing if you think about the structure of the way we bet on basketball as opposed to other sports, which is it seems to be the sort of sport that's really ripe for corruption. If you think about it, what a player cares about is whether or not he wins the game. What a gambler cares about is whether or not you beat the spread.
Yeah.
And so you have this disjunction between the two. And as a result, it seems like there's a nice little win-win for the two when the two get together, which is the gambler simply says to the player, go ahead, play your heart out, make sure you win the game because that's what you care about. Just make sure not to win by too much.
But
given that the player doesn't care about the margin, what the heck?
And you felt like basketball was a little bit different from the other sports where this also could take place, where a team could win but not cover the spread.
Yeah, so it'd be very hard to do something like this in soccer, for instance, because, you know, we have 2-1 games, things like that. And in football, I think it's a lot harder because it's not obvious in football who it is you'd need to bribe in order to control the game outcome. Maybe the quarterback, but, you know, no individual footballer has quite as much control over the outcome as any individual basketballer.
Well, and it says within the story here, you're part of a new generation of forensic economists. What does that mean?
It's basically combing your way through data to try and find evidence of wrongdoing or corruption. And what one needs to do is you sit down and you think about how people would be corrupt in a particular setting and if that would leave footprints in the data. And in this setting, what it would mean, for instance, is teams that are 12-point favorites would maybe win the game by 9, 10, or 11 points far too often, but win the game by 13, 14, or 15 not often enough.
So it was more the large spreads where you saw something which stood out.
Yeah, it's also, I think, what you'd sort of expect. If my team was a 3-point favorite to win tonight's game, I could offer a point spread, point shave, and, you know, try and win the game by 1 or 2 points. But truth is, that I'd be taking a real big gamble and I might end up losing the game there as a result. So I certainly would feel a lot more comfortable point shaving if I were a player, if I had a really big spread and could therefore be really certain that I could both win the game and also make sure that my gambler friends won their bets.
So it was pretty much the data, the results, and the point spread as opposed to somebody from a particular school or Las Vegas or college coaches saying, yeah, we saw something which really stood out.
That's what motivated the study. Now I've actually gone back and had a look at all of the point-shaving episodes that we're aware of, you know, looking through old court cases, legal documents, and so on. And not all of them fit the pattern that I've described, but a heck of a lot of them do. They really are. You know, basketball's much more prone to this than are other sports. That it's really been teams on average that have, you know, really big point spreads, and it's just, you know, and the other thing about the NCAA is these are amateur players, and so the potential cost to them of getting caught is pretty low. You know, they're going to lose a career that they're currently being paid nothing for anyway. So we've seen historically quite a lot of this with college basketball. You know, of course, the very worst case we ever saw was the Chicago Black Sox, which was baseball, but they're also, the players felt mistreated, and saw an opportunity to make some money, potentially at the cost of a boss they didn't much care for.
So within the story here, it suggests you're talking about potentially 5% of all games with large spreads have been fixed. Is that right?
That's my best guess, and I want to be clear. That's an estimate, you know, and no number's exactly correct. But I'd say, you know, I've examined pretty much every major college basketball game over the last 16 years, that's 44,000 games. And over those 44,000 games, my guess is that probably around 500 of them involve some form of point shaving, because it really is only the strong favorites that I can pick up any sort of ill activity.
That's a huge accusation, though, right? I mean, 500 games have been fixed?
So some of the 500 we already knew about, like the Arizona State scandal Boston College. So we probably already knew about a dozen of these.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my number's not completely inconsistent with some of the NCAA's own data. They run surveys, anonymous surveys, when they ask players, do you have any friends that have ever point shaved? But their numbers tend to tell you about, you know, 1% to 2% of players are aware of it having occurred. Now, that doesn't tell you how often it occurs either. I regard that as being roughly consistent. And I've got to tell you, if you want to try and find crime and corruption, the last way of measuring crime is to ask people how many crimes they committed. They have a tendency not to do it. But that said, those numbers are roughly consistent with mine.
What about the idea that those folks who set point spreads, especially when we're talking about, you know, heavy favorites, they're really good at this.
They're really good at this.
You know, and they've just studied it over a long period of time, and let's say the number's 12. I'll tell you what, it ends up around 10 to 14 on a regular basis, not because guys are on the take, but because historically it's just worked out that way.
Chad, you're exactly right, and that's an entirely correct description of what the data looks like. But here's the difficult thing. If the point spread is 12.5, you're right, we often see 10s and 11s, mm-hmm. 12s, but we don't quite as often see 13s, 14s, and 15s, and that's the smoking gun here.
Oh, so it's normally just a little bit below. So as you suggested earlier, the team wins, but guess what? The bookies who know about this also win because the number stays low.
I don't know if this is bookies or gamblers.
Yeah.
I want to be clear about that, but you're exactly right. And we don't see this pattern for short favorites. It's only for these very heavy favorites that have the opportunity to point spread, to point shave. So it's the asymmetry here. It's not the fact that the game so often turns out to be near the point spread. That's what I think an economist would expect. It's the fact that they're far too often, when it's close to the point spread, to the line, they lose to the spread rather than beating the spread.
And that was the Stevens Smith case out at Arizona State, right? They were winning these games.
Absolutely.
But and he was having some big nights too. He had some games where, you know, he scored above his average, but still was involved with his team staying below the number.
Yeah. And it's quite interesting if you look at some of the transcripts from the historic cases. The City College case in the 50s is the most famous point shaving scandal, and you look at the instructions that a gambler gives the player for a game, and it's not go out there and miss. And that's why it's so hard to use conventional forensics to figure out whether point shaving is occurring. These guys aren't missing free throws, they're not missing two, you know, dunks or anything like that. What you do is you just stand a foot back in defense. Now, your coach might be able to tell that, but almost no one else in the stadium can, and a good NCAA player will be able to score over the top of you every time when you're playing like that.
Justin Wolfers is our guest from the Wharton School of Business. His data, his research on college basketball and the potential of games fixed. Looking at this story also, you were talking about the NCAA before. Here's another point they make. A recent NCAA poll, 1.5% of players admitted knowing of a teammate who took money for playing poorly. That's a pretty startling statement, don't you think?
It's even more startling when they're talking about their friends, because I got to tell you, I'm not so sure I'd be telling the NCAA about my buddies.
How does the NCAA, whether it's Miles Brand or others, how have they responded when they've been asked either about this response from the players or did you present this data to top officials with the NCAA?
So I've not talked to the NCAA directly, but David Leonhardt, the journalist at the New York Times who broke this story, did talk to the NCAA. They actually had a fairly nuanced and I think quite sensible position, which is they're willing to admit that gambling is a problem with college sports. They're not sure if the number's 1.5% or my number 5%. Perhaps they think I overstate it, but, you know, to be honest, I think that we're closer to agreeing than disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what the NCAA is actually doing, they really do campaign quite hard against gambling on college sports. So I think that, you know, in the backs of their minds, this isn't a complete surprise either. I will say that this actually suggests a different policy prescription than the NCAA has been putting forward. They're just against all kinds of gambling all the time. I think that's actually very hard to make happen in reality. But the real problem here is point spread betting, right? That's where you get this very simple case where I can, as a player, I can still do what I want to do, win the game, and all I have to do is win by a little bit less. If you've got to start paying a guy to actually lose the game instead, I think we're going to see a lot less corruption in sports.
But what can the NCAA, what could the NFL, what could Major League Baseball do about that when Vegas is immensely popular and also internet gambling. Offshore gambling is only getting bigger and bigger, and more people would suggest that even if sports try to crack down on this, that the players, the participants, still might be vulnerable.
Yeah, Chad, I think that's a really important point. Regulating gambling was a lot easier business 10 years ago when it was all officially, at the very least, occurring in Las Vegas. The way gambling regulation works in the U.S. is essentially that the government has said it's illegal, you can't do it. And that's one policy position. But what that also means is essentially what they've done is they've elected to leave it unregulated. And as a result, there's often footprints that you get left behind in the data, for instance, in the betting data, that could tip the authorities off if they were cooperating and regulating, actively regulating sports books. So I'll give you an example. In Britain, there were some recent scandals with jockeys that were basically not trying on the horses that they were riding, and they were betting that their horse would lose. The large betting operations there that took a lot of bets against those horses actually tipped off the authorities. And it's by the fact that they were regulating them and then therefore monitoring their data, that's what actually gave them the leg up to actually discover the corruption.
Well, let me ask you about another part of this story where a gentleman from the Las Vegas Hilton responded to your conclusions, and he said they sounded ludicrous.
Yeah.
Did you expect that sort of response from the casinos themselves, or do you think this individual from just one casino, the Hilton, maybe is different from what, you know, other folks representing different casinos might say?
I expected it for a very simple reason. It's not a criticism I take seriously, and the reason is simply, who is it who has a huge vested interest in making sure that you and I believe that when we bet fairly?
Yeah.
It's the sports books. And so, not surprisingly, the sports books call this ludicrous without giving any substantive reason as to why the research may be problematic. I think the research is suggestive. It's certainly not definitive and certainly not proof. And I would hope that that's the line that they would take in the future. I think I take the NCAA's line a lot more seriously. They're really interested in the integrity of the sport rather than the integrity of the betting market. And that they think that there's a problem here, but maybe they argue about the magnitudes. I think I'm comfortable with that.
So do you think they will be more aggressive, whatever the method might be, over the next 5, 10 years, or maybe even a shorter period of time, whether it's reacting specifically to what you've suggested or maybe what their own research has showed them?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they have been very aggressive on these issues. Actually, Senator McCain has, John McCain's been fairly aggressive on these sorts of issues as well. I'm not sure that the NCAA has necessarily the right approach, but I think they have the right view about this. They're much more of the view that a lot of their policies seem to be about stamping out any form of gambling on college campuses. Now, I don't think the problem here is that a guy on the baseball team happens to have a bet on football. It just doesn't strike me as being remotely relevant. The problem here is the peculiar incentives that happen when you have amateur athletes and point spread betting, and so players who have essentially nothing to lose by shaving a few points here and there.
Well, and Justin Wolfers is our guest from the Wharton School of Business. His research on gambling in college basketball, because of the number you tossed out, let's say it's close to right, whether it's maybe a little bit lower or a little bit higher, with the number of media outlets, with kids who are vulnerable, and you could have individuals who are worth a lot of money, they could scare these individuals. Don't you think if something like this was taking place, a major scandal would have been reported more recently than, you know, the Arizona State story, the Boston College stories from even longer ago?
The Northwestern story from a few years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
The fact that it's a reasonable case. How much of it should we expect to see? When I've talked to former players, they don't regard this as being deeply surprising. They're of the view that some of this is probably going on, but probably not a heck of a lot. We have had, I think, regular as clockwork, a really good, solid scandal once every decade, and a whole lot of hints and innuendo about a whole bunch of other teams floating around, if not definitive proof in any case.
Well, if it comes out, let's say, once a decade, your research would suggest many more instances of gambling, you know, went away from media coverage, where the media and the NCAA or other investigators did not know about it, correct?
Exactly. This is a very hard crime to catch. All you have to do is play defense a little less well, and the only people who know are you and the gambler.
Justin, thank you very much. Nice topic, and as you continue to cover this, we'll follow it, maybe have you on once again.
Sounds fun. Look forward to it.
Justin Wolfers, our guest from the Wharton School of Business, will react to this topic, include a phone call or two if you are so interested.